Morning. Jinsco versus Johnson.
Morning, Your Honors. My name is John Pierce, and I'm here on behalf of the appellants, Jason and Tricia Johnson, in this matter.
Do you wish to reserve any time?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes, if I could, please. Thank you. This case is about the breadth of power of a continuing guarantee. It's about the question of what's required to make that guarantee and what's composed of the material terms of the guarantee, and it's about the guarantor's right not to have their obligations enlarged without their consent. In the Superior Court, they ruled that the guarantee as it stood was continuing and that it...
Well, doesn't it say that?
It does, Your Honor. But I don't believe that they... I don't believe that the court correctly created the terms of that guarantee when it said it was continuing, and that's based on the facts of the case. When Mr. Johnson originally applied, he was a minority shareholder, or actually member, of an LLC.
Well, then, aren't you asking us to alter the plain language of the continuing personal guarantee?
I think the guarantee is composed of several documents that were executed at the same time. And Lynch v. Higley says when instruments are executed together, they're to be construed together. And in this case, the guarantee was executed along with the application, and the application stated that Mr. Johnson was requesting a credit line of $10,000. That same day...
Well, isn't it precise?
Precise was, but Jason Johnson is the guarantor in this who's being held for that liability.
Right.
So precise on whom he was applying on their behalf was requesting a $10,000 credit line. They were approved for a $5,000 credit line. This all happened on the same day and at the same time. So I think if there's a question of the amount of the guarantee, it's between the $5,000 and the $10,000. The issue that is here is that Jinsco opened additional accounts. I think this may be the only fact that's in dispute in that they say that they were sub-accounts and the plaintiffs believe that they were additional accounts. But all the other facts...
They were accounts for Precise, were they not?
They were accounts for Precise. They were accounts for Precise in different locations. When Mr. Johnson opened up account number 44301. That was the original account that was opened for $5,000 and was later increased to $15,000. It was a year after that Jinsco opened three additional accounts for Precise, one in Kennewick, one in Yakima, and an additional one in Spokane for a Home Depot account. Now, when they issued those, it wasn't Mr. Johnson who asked those accounts to be done. They didn't ask his consent. Would he guarantee those accounts up to those values?
But it was Precise who obviously wanted those accounts open.
It is Precise, but Mr. Johnson is a 14% shareholder.
But doesn't the guarantee state that guarantee covers all existing and future indebtedness of the applicant? Precise.
And Precise has held it. We're not arguing on Precise's behalf. There's a default judgment that was entered against Precise in those amounts.
No, I'm talking about the personal guarantee says this guarantee covers all existing future indebtedness of the applicant.
Consistent with what was with the application. Again, these documents were executed together, whereas the additional accounts came a year afterwards without his request. I would argue that if... You know, up to $10,000 for any fees and interest or other ongoing cost, of course it would encompass those, and if those interests kept accruing, it could exceed that $10,000 limit. But what happened here is that Jinsco increased these lines of credit by 1,500%. I mean, this is you know, if you had a partnership credit card and the credit card company said, well, your buddy called and increased your credit line by 1,500%, we're going to hold you to your guarantee that we did a year ago. 3 years after that fact, I think this would be a totally different argument here.
Well, now, Mr. Johnson did rescind the guarantee in, what, 2014?
So
he rescinded the guarantee in 2014. He could have done that sooner, couldn't he?
To be clear on that fact, it was the business partner who wrote a letter to Gensco asking Gensco, Don Rock was the majority shareholder.
Uh-huh.
It was he who wrote a letter to Gensco asking them to rescind both his and Mr. Johnson's guarantee, Mr. Rock's and Mr. Johnson's.
Did Rock have a separate guarantee that we don't have in the record?
We have not found one. There was not one brought up in discovery, and we don't know if that existed.
So it's Rock who writes the letter that rescinds the guarantee on behalf of Johnson?
That
letter could have been written sooner, couldn't it?
It could have, but Mr. Johnson was...
So Johnson could have rescinded this guarantee at any point.
He didn't believe that he was responsible for all five accounts at this point. He believed he was responsible for the Spokane account.
So why was the guarantee rescinded in 2014?
We were not able to depose Don Rock because he's very difficult to find, and that fact is not in the record.
So we don't know.
We do not know in the record.
And I guess that explains why you don't know if Rock had a guarantee.
We asked. I mean, we did depose the regional credit manager, Sherry Rosebloom, for Gensco.
She's in the record.
Who applied for these accounts? Is there another guarantee? And those facts were not forthcoming. We did ask for those documents in discovery, and they weren't forthcoming, so we believe they don't exist. We don't believe there's another guarantee based upon that action. So,
and we don't know why Rock wrote that letter.
We can only guess.
I don't think we can do that for
It's not in the record. I have lots of guesses. they're not admissible here, Your Honor.
Okay, well, for purposes of addressing an opinion, we're not going to guess. All right.
I'll just rest my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Good morning, Your Honor. William Charbonneau for the respondent, Gensco Incorporated. Thank you. To address some of the questions that were raised just now, I'm not sure if it came out in Ms. Roseboom or not, but I think it did. Rock thought he signed a guarantee, and that's why he wanted to rescind his too. We never found one.
Whatever letter he wrote was effective to rescind Johnson's guarantee.
We treated it that way, and if they want to retreat from that letter, then we're fine to hold them responsible for the entire debt.
Well, no, I don't. Yeah. Okay. So, what about their argument that because these documents, and I don't think there's any dispute that the documents were executed contemporaneously, in other words, the credit application and the guarantee, that Mr. Johnson was limited to a guarantee to $10,000. Why isn't that a persuasive argument?
Well, typically, yes, they are contemporaneous when they're executed, but they're separate documents. In the Souder case, recites that these are two different obligations, a credit app with the principal and a guarantee with a whole different person, the guarantor.
But the credit application does note it's for no more than a $10,000 credit line.
Correct, but the guarantee is not so limited. And even in the McAllister case, you read the guarantee on its own terms, and you don't look to other extrinsic evidence.
Well, that seems contrary to the Lynch case, where you're supposed to look at all of the documents together.
Well, that's a kind of general contract, but not when you're dealing with an unlimited, unconditional, absolute guarantee that says opposite of what those documents say. When he signed that guarantee, he knew it's every and all indebtedness this company may have, he knew that there'd be future.
Does that include the accounts that were later opened and the significant increase in the amounts that were incurred?
I believe so, because it says all indebtedness existing future with the contemplation that it may change. It's not limited to one transaction. And those were opened up by whom? They were opened by Precise. And this is one entity. This isn't, they could have got escaped liability, for example, having Precise Wenatchee Incorporated and Precise Yakima Incorporated, and they'd be different entities, and the guarantee would not extend to them. But this is a single entity. Now, when Starbucks opens a new store, and if
and is the record clear that this is a single entity?
Yes. It would, all stores were owned by one LLC, and it's Precise, and that's not in dispute. And to limit it to an address on the credit app, I mean, what if they close the Spokane store and move somewhere else, and all of a sudden there's no guarantee? You could just get out of your guarantee by moving.
Well, was that their place of business, the Spokane?
That was their headquarters. That's where all store statements, all invoices went there. That's and Mr. on the credit app, it shows Mr. Johnson. He's the accounts payable person. He's the person receiving all invoices, all account statements, and he's paying us.
Is he the CFO or the CEO? It's a little unclear from looking
at
that.
Well, it's an LLC, so he's a managing member. I don't think they really have those titles.
Well, there's something on the credit application.
I don't have that in front of me. What is it listed as?
Well, it's unclear whether it's EO or FO. You don't know.
That never came up.
Okay. So what was his role? What do you understand Mr. Johnson's role was?
He was in owner of the company, and he was in charge of accounts payable.
Now, how do you know he was in charge of accounts payable?
It lit on the credit app, first page, I believe, somewhere in the middle. It says his name, and it says accounts payable. And I think it has Don Rock as sales manager. I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor.
Does it make a difference that he's a minority owner?
I don't think so. He's a guarantor. He doesn't have to be an owner at all. The fact that he's an owner at all makes him a compensated guarantor. Burden on him is a lot higher than, say, an uncompensated guarantor. For example, if I guarantee a car loan for my nephew, I'm uncompensated. I'm doing just out of love and affection. But if you have a financial interest in the business, you're compensated. And as far as the rescission goes, you know, he understood when, I mean, he has to take ownership of it. He's being rescinded by it. The size of the company has outgrown the ability to, for any one individual to guarantee. Well, he's understanding that when it goes out, he has to take responsibility for that. And then, as the Cessna Finance Court, and this addresses something you'd said, as the Cessna Finance Corp said, that if guarantor wanted to limit an unconditional, unlimited guarantee, they could have done so in the guarantee. I take that a step further. A guarantor, he rescinded it later, but a guarantor can do a lot of things after the fact. He, instead of rescinding, he could have said, look, this is getting out of control. I just want to do the Spokane store from now on. Or I want to limit it to $20,000 from now on, or both, Spokane and $20,000. You could have done a lot of things after the fact. And he's the one that's monitoring the accounts payable and receiving the statements and paying us. He's writing the checks. So he knows what's going on. So he, at any time, he could limit it, and that's what the Cessna Finance Corp. But it starts with the original guarantee. It's unlimited. It's every debt of every type whatsoever. And the reason they're written that way is it's an ongoing. Sometimes these go on for years.
Well, here it did.
Right. And then they open in new stores, business chains. I mean, when they sign this, both sides are sitting there saying, I hope you grow, and I hope you don't have a lot of stores, because then we're all making money, right? So they're expected to have expansion.
What about their argument related to the allocation of the payments that were made to the previously to the oldest debt, and then the change in that course of conduct?
Right. Okay, so in the beginning, on all their accounts, it's applied to oldest debt first, when you have an open account.
Right.
And that works to everybody's benefit, otherwise it would be in default.
So that was what you did, and then you changed it.
That's correct. Once the default occurred, Your Honor, there's no longer that course of performance. Once the default occurred and entered in the note, then Jinsco is going to apply those to their best interest. And their policy, and this is in Jim Albert's certification, their policy is to apply it to non-secured invoices first, whether secured by a lien or a guarantee or anything. That is their policy.
Now where is that policy?
He stated it in one of the affidavits or certifications of James Albert. There's three of them. I'd have to go. Probably in the first one.
Okay, so one of Albert's declarations.
Right. Once it goes in default and you're in a note situation, we kind of throw the oldest first out the window. We're going to apply it to our best interest and provide the best security for our
company. Can you always do that, or are there limitations on that?
I think it depends. First of all, that's a good answer, isn't it? The first place to look is the what does the credit app say? The credit app says Gensco can apply payments at their own discretion. No limitation. The case law says the creditor can apply payments as it deems fit. Now, the exception to that is when you give instructions on how that payment is applied. If you say, here's $10,000, I want you to apply it to the invoice on the Johnson job,
right,
that's what you have to do. And no doubt, there's no instructions were ever given. I mean, quite frankly,
do you have to do instructions before the default?
No, at the time of any payment.
No?
I mean, when they made the promissory note payments, they could have said, here's our payment number one. Please, we request you apply them to the oldest invoices first. Yeah. We would have to honor that request, regardless of what our policy was. Because otherwise, I mean, you accept the payment, you accept how to apply it.
Okay.
And then, I don't know if you want to get the UCC. It seems he cites the UCC on that issue. And that's totally inapplicable because it says, if you have an agreement that says how it's going to be applied, you know, at your discretion,
right,
that you can't bring in new evidence to contradict that. You can explain it or aid the court in presuming to construct some term you don't understand, but if it's otherwise clear and unambiguous, then that whole UCC is not helpful to us. 50 seconds left, Your Honor. What we didn't address was the promissory note, and I think that's the easiest one in there. I mean, it said, what does the guarantee say? It says, you agree not to be. There's a lot of ways to get released from a guarantee, and there's a lot of case law on how it happens, including entering in a note, so you better have your guarantee, and this one had a laundry list. Like, you agree not to be released if we do A, B, C, D, E. And one of them is a promissory note. If we take a note on payment of this account or otherwise.
Oh, that's the installment note argument.
Right. That's the promissory note argument. I don't know. He's never addressed that language. And he argues novation. And in 14 seconds, I'll tell you, there was mutual assent for a novation. It's not the mutual assent to enter in the note. It's the mutual assent necessary to enter the note and release him from his guarantee. And release was never mentioned, discussed, or even brought up.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ernest. I just wanted to point out a couple of issues with the plaintiff's argument here. And one is that when respondent was looking about how payments were applied, he referred to the credit application again when it came to the promissory note and the guarantee. So those are inextricably combined. And whenever we look at all these documents together, you can't pick the one that has the best terms for you and go, well, that's the one I want to listen to right now, because these other ones I want to ignore. The example was if there's a guarantee of a nephew's car payment. And that's a good example, because what if the nephew goes and buys 10 more cars at the dealership? That assent is not there to increase it to that much. This cent is there for the initial car, which was initially applied for. The dealership can't go, oh, we're going to go with the same promissory note to another 10 cars or another 3 accounts. The problem that we have with this is that Mr. Johnson was never contacted regarding the increase in credit limit. He believed it was for the Spokane store, not for a Tri-City store that had a $150,000 credit limit that was opened by somebody else and not him. Whenever this account was wrapped up, which was February 25th, 2014, Gensco issued a check in the amount of $22,000 and actually put the account number, 44301, when that account balance was about $4,000. So, you know, it was a clear effort that account was supposed to be cleared out. I don't think you can recapture a guarantee from the start and make it apply to everything without asking the person. And, you know, Wilson Court Limited Partnership is the case we've quoted in that, which says a guarantee is to be modified by mutual assent, and one party may not unilaterally modify it. It also says that silence is not acceptance of a modification. It has to be asked. There has to be that consent. It just seems to be a core of due process in a contract system. So I thank you for your time, unless you have questions.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.